Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Wouldn't you like to get the highest multiple possible for selling your company? Well, today we're going to have Gary Miller here from Gem Strategy, and he's going to give us the ins and outs of selling your company. He knows how to sell a company at the highest multiple. In fact, he sold his company to IBM for one of the highest multiples IBM has ever paid in their history. So he's going to join us and tell us what you need to do, what about market timing, all sorts of things. But before we get into that, we're going to talk to Eric Boone, who dresses people professionally in today's modern world. You know, I'd rather wear sweatpants all day, but I know that you're not supposed to do that. And so he's going to talk about what it really means to dress properly when the world doesn't really dress that well anymore. And so how do you dress professionally and still dress in style and not stick out because you're overdressing? So he's going to talk about that and give us some tips. So now let's welcome Eric Boone to the program. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Okay, so what does it mean to dress professionally nowadays? Can you just wear jeans and a t-shirt and dress like a slob and be professional? Or do you have to? I mean, what's going on?
Well, over the last, I would say, even couple of decades, it has really taken a transformation. Dress professionally, and it still denotes professional. but, you know, so many companies have moved away from suits and ties and, you know, professional dress. So you can still be professional and still be casual. But some people have, a lot of companies have done away with their dress code or have relaxed it, and so therefore, this is what we have today, kind of a free-for-all, if you will, in many ways. But what I think it means to dress professionally is to look your best, so that you always project a good image for your, not only for yourself, but for whoever the company or brand that you're representing.
So you can wear jeans and a t-shirt, but it needs to be a nice pair of jeans and a t-shirt that doesn't say, some beer logo on it or something.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it really depends on what industry you're working into. If you're wearing jeans and you're going to go that route, you know, maybe the more creative feels you can get by with that, like internet or something like, you know, those more creative computer or that type of thing where that's acceptable. But, you know, more in the more professional business, I wouldn't recommend that you would wear jeans and t-shirt like that. That would be kind of taken away from the brand that they represent, you know, kind of their image. So you want to step it up when you're in those kind of industries, like banking and, you know, a lawyer or something of that nature. Yeah.
You need to dress like you're smart.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and to be real, if you were dressing in a suit all the time and you were in a creative environment, it probably wouldn't be good either, right?
It'd be out of place. You know, it's like, why would a person go, want to work for, maybe somewhere where they change oil and you wouldn't wear a suit to that, you know? So, obviously that's more, they may have a uniform or it's more relaxed or like that. So just, it really depends on the industry that you're working in that makes a determination of your style. But even if it is in a creative environment, you still want to, you know, have some sort of sense of decorum, even when you're very casual. People have graphic tees and hoodies on and those, but that's the kind of environment that sort of fosters that. But if you're in something that's a little bit more dignified, then yeah, you definitely want to step it up, that's for sure.
And maybe dress with a certain style to it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you're in a creative environment, you have to look like you're creative.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And, you know, there's something called smart dressing, too. You can do that. And I think that kind of goes hand in hand with that creativity, you know, where it's a little bit more stylish, but it's, you're still casual, but, you know, you have a sort of flair. You know, you work in technology, do something that's kind of almost kind of tech inspired, you know, that's kind of fun. And it kind of sets you apart from the rest of the crowd, you know, but in a good way.
What about women who dress too sexy? Is that bad?
I think so. you know, there's
I do
a way
know.
to
I'm just.
there, you know, there's a way to do it and not be provocative. I mean, I think that's really sending the wrong message, and you don't want to do that. So I think you really want to always do something, you know, always want to have dignity when you want to dress for success, because we are a nation of first impressions. And so however you dress, that's how you're going to be perceived, good or bad. So it's always best to step it up and, you know, save the, you know, that kind of thing for, you know, after work clubs or whatever. So that's kind of the best put for work.
Well, that's a good point. Do you have to be careful even after work, depending on what you're doing, or no?
Well, it depends. Let's say, for instance, maybe there's a mixer with your company is going to be where you might have to be mixing with clients or introducing yourself to new clients. Then you still want to dress in a way that's, you know, it can be after work, but it's still appropriate and still professional. It still projects that you're serious about who you represent and that kind of thing. So you don't want to give the wrong impression, especially for new or potential clients. So that's all.
Yeah, definitely if you're around clients. So could dressing for success really give you an edge in business? I mean, how much of an edge can it give you?
I think it gives you a huge edge. It's like what I told one client. I said, it's the difference between Joe, guy who's been there for 15, 20 years. He comes to work, he's a schlub, and then the new guy comes, he works there a year, 2 years, he's dressing for success. He's like, I'm on the fast track. He gets the promotion, and I've been here for 15 years. Why didn't I get the job? Well, because he didn't project that brand that he was serious. He may have had the experience, but he's not really showing that in his appearance, and that's just as important. Yes, skills are definitely the thing, but they also want to see it in how you look, how you carry yourself, and that goes. I think that plays a big part into it as well.
It shows that you care.
Yeah, that's right.
So, what are some good tips for dressing well without spending a fortune?
Well, one thing, the nice thing, especially like here in the Midwest in Minnesota, you know, this is a land of bargains. So,
which is kind of nice.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like that.
You can, you know, a person on an extremely tight budget can dress really well and look, you know, dignified. You don't have to spend a lot of money. I mean, we have so many options now that people can do. And for people that are hard to fit, let's say, because some people have like, you know, like when they buy a suit, they say, why, you know, the suit doesn't, you know, the pants don't fit me, and I need something that my waist is a little different than what this is. Well, the nice thing is that a lot of the stores have separates now, so you can buy suits separate. So even if the, you know, you can buy the pants with a different or odd size, doesn't have to go exactly with the same jacket size. Like when you buy a suit, it has to go exactly with the suit size. Now you can buy them separate so that you can get the right fit for you.
So I can't just wear sweatpants because I gained 10 pounds? I like sweatpants. I'm kidding.
No. Well, unless you're like a yoga instructor. Or something like
yes,
that.
Exactly. That makes sense. Well, that's a good point, because I know that when I go to find pants, it's so hard. I think a lot of women and men probably too. I don't know. I guess I'm not
yeah.
a man. It's so hard to find pants that fit me.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm always frustrated, but, you know, but when I lose weight and I'm in shape and I'm feeling good, it's like suddenly everything fits me, and then, but it doesn't last. That's why I like the sweatpants.
It's our comfort there.
So do you have any lasting tips that people should, that could really help us as we go, as we end this up, as we wrap this up?
Well, I would say, always try to look your best. I mean, even if you're casual, I mean, if you're going to, you know, if you're wearing jeans, you know, wear nice jeans, great jeans. You know, always the darker denims are the best. You know, don't do the ones with the holes in them and just allow people in. And, you know, because you can always dress jeans up. You can dress them up. You can dress them down.
So the darker ones are better.
Yes.
They look
sure.
more.
Yeah. And the one pet peeve that I have that I wish, and it's especially really geared toward guys, but some women too, is their shoes. A lot of these guys are wearing, they don't polish their shoes, and they're wearing tennis shoes to work. They're just not even caring.
How about shaving? I mean, they need to make sure they're always freshly shaven, right?
Well, you know, there's this big trend with the bushy beard thing now, which is kind of, I don't have a problem with beards. I think if they're done nicely, they look great. But the ones that I'm seeing are really kind of like an overgrowth of just like a beehive.
So you can have a beard, it just needs to be trimmed.
If it's trimmed nicely and done well, it can look very elegant. But a lot of guys don't have the head or face for a beard. It actually makes their head and face look fatter and bigger. So that's not a good
thing. It's not doing what you think.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, well,
And can I just say, too, about for women, like, especially like for shoes, like if the women, I see a lot of women, especially in the summertime, the warmer months where they're wearing like open-toed or slingbacks.
Yes.
Make sure that they're, you know, they have a pedicure, that their feet are not looking like the bottom of an ashtray. Because
like
I do see a lot of that.
Growing.
So. Businesswoman. We're talking businesswoman we're talking here. So that's kind of like, if you're going to wear those, you know, please make sure that you have your heels and feet pedicured. So, because that's important.
Sure, that does make sense. Mm-hmm. Well, now you do this professionally for people, right? You've been on different TV shows, and you do. How does it work? So, if somebody is an executive or somebody wants, I mean, how does it work?
Well, a lot of people find me, when I do like speaking engagements, do seminars. That's one way I get my clients. Also, my clients refer people to me. That's one way, and then people have found me through LinkedIn.
Okay.
And just out of the blue and say, hey, I'd like to set an appointment. So what I do first is, before we even do any kind of shopping, is we always, always, always do a sit-down consultation first before we do anything, because that will determine what their needs are. We may not need to do a wardrobe, a complete wardrobe. Maybe they just need something for the day or for a speaking engagement or some other kind of thing. They just want to dress to impress for something. Or maybe they just need a closet audit. That's why I always do a sit down with them.
And that's a good point. You only need probably, if you have just a few events, you only need a few really nice outfits, right?
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have things in their closet and they don't even have to do any shopping. They don't even realize that. But they just like, people just get overwhelmed and say, oh, I don't have anything. But when I do a closet audit, it's like, you have great stuff. I'm like, really? And then, I put it together for them, like, wow, I didn't know I had that. And there it is. That's another option too. So there's a lot of ways that people can do it. And I've worked with everybody from college students going to their first job interview to job seekers over 45 who are going, who are out of work and trying to get work to, executives to you name it.
Have you ever had like a sales department where you come in and just speak to the group of salespeople and say, hey, this is how we want to represent our brand and this is what we want to do?
You mean like a corporate, a company?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do a number of speaking engagements with companies around the Twin Cities. A lot of lunch and learn sessions. I go to the U of M. I go to business colleges all over. And it's always a packed house. And it's just kind of always amazing. It's like, because I always think that, oh, no one's going to come want to hear that. But I'm like, wow.
Well, it's true, because all of us are, it's one of those things, oh, man, there's a certain way I want to dress. But
right. Mm-hmm.
How do I dress when I'm in front of everybody and everybody's judging me? Although I don't really care much, but I know it's important.
But I get a lot of questions and it's great. And I like to, when I do those, I like to have make it more interesting. I'll have some drawings at the end of the session and just to thank people for coming. And I'll bring merchandise to actually, clothing to show them and put outfits together so they can actually see. And that gives people a nice visual as well, so they can actually see how things look. So,
well, this is great. Well, can I include your information on the radio page so that
Absolutely.
They? Okay. Well, good. Well, I will do that. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, if you want to see more from Eric Boone, you can access him on my website for contact information at sarahwestall.com. Now we have Gary Miller, and he's going to tell us how to get it done. How to sell your company for the highest multiple possible. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? We want to, if we're building this company and it's our baby, when we sell it, we want to get the most we possibly can. So now let's welcome Gary Miller to the program. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
You sold your company back in 2000 to IBM. You had a global consulting firm, and IBM specifically bought you because of your intellectual intellectual property, and you also had a unique ability to access higher-level executives, which IBM really wanted. Could you explain that to us a little bit on what, why they wanted to buy your company and how that went?
I sure can. Thanks for having me on the show. I can tell you that IBM had been a client of ours for 5 years. So they had experience with our subject matter expertise and our capabilities, etc. part of why they wanted us was because we invented some predictive modeling techniques that was very applicable to their client base. However, when you are dealing in the management consulting space, you typically access different executives in what's called the C-suite, the chief of technology or the,
sure,
the chief financial officer, et cetera. We had access to the higher levels in the C-suite, the CEO, the CFO, and the COO, and more often than not, those three people occupying those positions also sat on the board of directors. In the case of IBM, they were kind of capped out. They could only access the chief technology officer because IBM is a technology leader. Therefore, they really couldn't get upstairs, as we say, to make contact with and acquire major strategic engagements unless it revolved around infrastructure or the merging or combining of disparate systems, those kinds of things. So they were really capped at that.
So you really had a valuable asset that they wanted, because, you know, you hear IBM and you think, oh, wow, they probably had access to all levels. But it doesn't work that way in the business world. And you could come in there and you could get them access to the strategic decision makers. So because you had that, were you able to demand a higher price on the value of your company?
Well, I think the pricing, the multiple that we receive based on our EBITDA, the earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, was above normal. In fact, we received among the highest they've ever paid for a consulting firm. And there were two reasons. One, you've identified the access, and then the other is that we had invented some predictive modeling techniques using the latest and greatest in technology developed by NASA and other organizations, and they were fearful that we might sell our company or that technology to one of their competitors.
So they wanted you before one of the competitors could get to you, and they gave you a price that would get you to move.
That's correct. And we chose to make that decision to sell because it was at the right time. The market was strong in terms of multiples being paid for service companies.
Yeah, you were smart. You went at the
number two.
Go ahead.
We decided that, you know what, given where we're going, we might have to fight a long time when we did get ready to sell. If we didn't sell to IBM, we'd probably have to fight a long time to get as good a purchase price as we did. That was clearly number one.
Timing's a big deal, isn't it?
It's a huge deal. In fact, it's one of the five major considerations any business owner should take into account when they're ready to sell their company.
Sure. Okay. What is the biggest difference? I mean, I know you help a lot of companies, you know, to sell their companies. So what do you think is the biggest difference between 2000 and now?
Actually, I think it's more difficult for a business owner to sell today than it was in 2000, 15 years ago. And here are some of the reasons why. First, there is a tsunami of companies coming on the market, Sarah. And as a result of that, the competition is going to be very stiff for one company to stand out over another company in the same industry and set. And this is a result of the baby boomer generation of owners. And they own 43% of all privately held companies. And basically, you're going to have about 400,000 companies coming on the market annually compared to just a few years ago when there was around 1,400 companies coming on the market. Now, while I say that to you, there's a lot of what we call dry powder, that is money on the sideline wanting to buy companies. And so as a result of that, There's plenty of opportunity to be purchased, but there's significant competition to stand out among your peers.
Well, you know, I had someone else earlier talk about the middle market segment and that there is actually a lot of competition on investing in the middle market. Is it more that there isn't that many really strong companies that are out there, or is it that there's just a lot of companies that just aren't as exciting to be involved with?
No, there's two basic reasons why privately held companies do not sell quickly. First, the company owners overvalue them. They try to reach up and get too big a price for them. And number two, the companies are not well prepared to go to market. Those are the two major reasons. I might add, Sarah, currently, as of last year, 83% of all companies up for sale did not sell.
And what do you think is the biggest reason for that?
They are not prepared for the marketplace. And I can give you some examples of what that lack of preparedness means. Their financial statements are not audited. Their books are not clean. They don't have a strategic business plan in place. They don't have sustainable growth business models in place. Or the bench strength of their management team is shallow.
So they're kind of a mess.
Another reason is, they're kind of a mess. And by the way, that's one of the major areas that we focus on, is helping companies prepare themselves to market. And many times that takes anywhere from 4 months to two and a half years going forward. There's three basic things that a buyer looks for in a company. One is a strong earnings growth year over year over year. Buyers want consistency. Number two, they want strong management in place. There's kind of a myth out there that if a company comes in and buys you, they're going to get rid of the management. In today's world, that's just the opposite. They want strong management in place.
Yeah, they don't want the headache, right? They want to come in and have something that works well. Okay.
That's right. And the third reason and final reason, they want a culture fit. I once did a deal with a strategic alliance for a company, a consulting company, with CenturyLink Telephone Company. That did not work out at all because the culture of a telephone company is drastically different than the culture of a consulting firm.
Well, a telecommunication company, a big one, is it's a big bureaucracy. It's like the government almost.
Almost.
Yeah. And so if you're getting a more innovative, you know, move on the fly type company, it's very difficult merged situation. I worked in at US West back in the day, and I worked in a really innovative part of that company but in order to make that happen, they actually carved out an entire space for us and then created a bubble around us so nobody would touch us. Otherwise, they knew the culture in the main company would kill the innovation. And it worked. It worked for a certain amount of time, but yeah, go ahead. So culture is a big difference.
It is. Just remember one axiom about culture. Culture eats strategy for breakfast.
It does. That's a great statement. Culture is almost everything.
It is. U.S. West was a client of ours in the company that I sold to Paragon. In fact, we had all eight of the RBOC and the long line carriers as clients, as one of our industry specialties was telecommunications.
Yep.
And, you know, as you would know, the telecommunications industry, once they went through divestiture, were kind of like bear cubs playing with themselves. They didn't know what to do, how to do it, because they'd never had to generate earnings on their own.
Exactly.
They had a captive audience. The consumer, they had protected territories, and they were able to raise their prices every time their costs went up.
They were kind of in la-la land. Business doesn't, they're like the government.
Well, they were. They're not, they're, Well, that's right. That's exactly. The only thing is they can't print money.
Well, the government can't either, right? The Federal Reserve doesn't. But regardless.
Yeah, they can print money, but the telephone companies can't.
Yes. So, okay. So are big companies always looking for good companies to purchase?
It depends on there's two types of growth, organic and inorganic. If their organic growth is significant, and if the industry they're in is pretty stable and consistent, then typically those companies' profile would not be having a major acquisition program or what we call inorganic growth. By contrast, companies that are in high growth markets often can't grow as fast organically for a number of reasons. So they add to that growth by aggressively acquiring either competitors or supporting companies, or they form strategic alliances or partnerships so that they can generate and maintain double-digit top-line growth numbers year over year.
And do they look for innovative companies to bring on board, like Google and Yahoo and all these companies are looking for the innovative companies to acquire, Apple? But do they do that because it's so much harder in their environment to create the innovative new products once they get to a certain size?
Well, Sarah, there's three basic ways you grow. In this end, you can grow, there's three different ways to grow in this end. You can build it yourself, or you can buy it, or you can make alliances, with companies you need. The problem with building it yourself is it takes time. If you buy it, you may pay a premium to buy it, but you collapse the time frame and therefore you become more competitive. By contrast, if a company won't allow itself to be sold, then you can form partnerships with that company. Or if you need the technology of a much larger company than yours, you can form partnerships or alliances with those companies to acquire the use of their technology or their innovation or their inventions, whatever that may be. So that decision to acquire is a function of what is the fastest way to get to a higher top line revenue number?
But we, you know, getting back to culture, you would say that it's not the culture issue with innovation isn't as big of a deal as just where they are in a pure business decision on where they can get the technology and, you know, whether they build
it. I think that's right. I think the culture issue, becomes very difficult to deal with on very large bureaucratic companies. IBM stated in the purchase of our company, we want what you got. Your billable rates are higher than ours on average. Your overhead is lower. You can turn proposals and engagements faster. We want to be able to do that. But the bottom line is that our company, even though we were a middle-sized consulting firm, we were a rounding error on IBM's balance sheet. And what happens when you try to do cultural integration is there are certain ways in which you do things. In the case of IBM, it was the IBM way. That's not to fault them for any reason. It is just the way it is. They've got their policies, practices, and procedures.
Were they able to take a company like yours and actually integrate it into theirs without losing that benefit? I would think they would have had to carve out a space and could put a little bit of bubble around it, like, you know, the experience I had.
The answer to that question is no, they were not able to integrate the firm successfully.
And so their purchase ended up being not the best purchase?
Well, it was for us. It depends on which side you bought.
Well, I know.
On the sell side, it was marvelous. It was an all-cash deal.
Well, they needed to realize that their culture, the reason why they can't do it is because of their culture. And in order to do it, you have to create a bubble around that little group and segment it off.
Yeah, well, they did not do that.
Okay. Well, that's not very smart. Ladies and gentlemen, don't do that. Well, okay, so did you, did they negotiate hard with you for a lower price, or did you pretty much be able, because of your access to executives and your proprietary intellectual property, were you able to get the fair market price or the value that you wanted without having to negotiate a lot? I know you got a higher value than what you normally would, you know, you got a pretty good deal going on, better than Ross Perot did for EDS.
I have forgotten what Ross did, the multiple he got for EDS, but there's a difference in the multiples by industry. I can tell you that there's two basic market values. There's fair market value, and then there's strategic market value. Strategic is always higher than fair market value. We got strategic market value, and they paid us the highest multiple they've ever paid for a consulting firm. And we hold that record to date, to this day.
That's awesome. So do most entrepreneurs get beaten down quite a bit over their price? And
it depends on their deal team, Sarah. One of the big mistakes that entrepreneurs or privately held company owners make is they don't put together professional deal teams. And let me give you, there's four critical deal team members you need. First and foremost, once you decide you're going to sell and you're preparing your company for sale, you need to hire a wealth planning firm. Why is that? Because if you don't do that and you wait to the very end, if you happen to get a verbal letter of intent or term sheet or letter of understanding, and if you get that either verbally or in writing 90 days before you have a wealth plan system in place, the IRS can disallow it.
Oh.
That leaves you with all kinds of tax implications around your deal. The second firm you need to hire is a major consulting firm, or one that is a transaction-based consulting firm, and we're one of those, by the way. So you need to hire that kind of firm to lead the deal team. Then you'll need a good investment banking firm on the bank firm side, and then you'll need a great transaction law firm and a great transaction tax firm. So there's five basic entities that you need to bring together, and that typically will, research is pretty clear on this, a business owner who will spend the money for a deal team typically winds up with more money in their pocket.
And they get scared of spending the money on the deal team, but if you get a good one, it'll actually way pay for itself. But the problem is finding a good one, right? I mean, we've all been hosed over with people that we hire, and we think by the end of that experience, we realize we could have done it better ourselves. So how do you make sure that you get a good deal team?
Yeah, that's right. The key ingredient there is, are they a transaction deal team? And I can't tell you how many times I've met with business owners, and God love them, you know, they'll say, well, you know, our corporate law firm has just been wonderful. We've been with them for 15 years. They've always done well. And I respond, but how many deals have they put together? Are they a transaction law firm or are they a corporate law firm? And you can bet that the buyer is going to have a transaction law firm on his team. And typically I've seen so often where entrepreneurs trying to sell their company just got beat at the negotiating table, because they wanted to be loyal and stick with their corporate law firm as opposed to hiring a transaction law firm.
Well, the same way they don't have
a transaction consulting firm.
Well, that's a really good point, because lawyers can often look at the world in many different lenses, and if they're looking at it from a standpoint,
well, the,
you have to be really careful to make sure the attorney's looking at it from, because they could wreck the deal. Right?
Well, that's right. That's right, Sarah. I use this analogy with business owners. You wouldn't go to a general practitioner for heart surgery. And what people have to understand is typically business owners sell their companies only once in their lifetime. They're expert at building their companies, but they're not very good at monetizing their companies.
Well, and their emotions get involved too, right?
Well, that's part of it, of course, but it's typically their lack of experience. They don't know current tax law. They don't understand the reps and warranties provisions of the purchase and sale agreement. They're unaware of add-backs to the EBITDA. They just simply don't understand the various components of a major transaction. And what we tell our clients is, look, this is a once-in-a-lifetime event, and it is a process. It isn't some magic moment in time that just happens because you decide you want to sell your company. It's a process. So you need deal team experts and a leader of that deal team to ensure you're going to maximize the value of your company and that you get the most cash and money for your firm.
Well, how big do you need to be before having a deal team make sense?
How big?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Well, I would tell you that your EBITDA should probably be $1.5 million to $2 million at the low side, and it goes up from there. So if you're making $1 million to $2 million a year, you better get a deal team in place, because as of the end of 2014, the multiple on the middle market valuations was 7.85 times EBITDA.
So if they're making $1 million, they should be able to turn around and get 7.5.
Well, that's the average. It depends on the condition of the company.
Sure, sure.
Those that are well prepared will get more. Those that are underprepared will get less.
And when do you think in a company life cycle it's a good time to sell a company?
When the markets are high. Typically, we say that the market, that a company is going to have its best opportunity to generate the highest enterprise value during its mid to late growth stage, before it hits maturity or before it's in decline.
Because they pay for the potential plus the market's higher, right?
Absolutely. No matter what a buyer pays for your company, he's going to look for two basic things. One, what is the sustainability of the current business model so that I can earn money too if I own this company? And the second thing he looks for is the synergies that can accrue by combining the two companies. That is, are there ways we can synergize each other's companies to lower our operating costs?
So what happens if you're just you want to sell your company, you're just burnt out, and the life cycle's not right? You know, life happens.
Sure. That often happens, particularly when an owner's health is at risk, or there's a divorce, or there's a loss of major accounts, or a single biggest account where their revenues are concentrated in too few accounts. That typically happens, and the owner gets discouraged, burnt out, and says, look, I've lived well, I've put back some savings, I just want to sell my company and get out. Those companies are going to suffer a very severe devaluation of their company.
So you just have to know. You just have to know that's the deal. You're going to get it based on the company life cycle, based on where the market's at. And if you're coming at it at not at peak time, you're going to suffer for that. But it's a business decision.
That's right. And there's a lot of things that go into that decision. The personal goals, the health, the stability of the marriage. If it's a family transfer, then it's the stability of the children in their marriages. It may be that the technology that you have is wearing out and that you haven't had a robust R&D program. So you want to sell it at a moment before the value of the company or the technology declines in its IP, intellectual property value. So there's lots of reasons that go into owners wanting to sell. And it isn't always about price. It often is about terms and conditions and the kind of company you're selling for, or selling to, I should say. So it isn't just about, I want to make a lot of money, although most owners do, don't get me wrong, but sometimes owners are financially comfortable and they want to sell their company to their employees. So they begin to look at an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program. There's lots of motivations behind owners' decisions to sell.
Because entrepreneurs aren't always motivated by money. There's other things that go on.
That's right.
Right? I mean, lots of research shows that money isn't the only deal. Well, how do you separate your ownership feelings so that the owner of the company, the founder, doesn't wreck the deal? Because I know it's a very emotional time.
Well, it is. Let me answer that a bit differently. I can use my personal example, and then I can use how we consult with our clients to allow us to do the negotiation, because all we want to do is make a good deal happen. And we try to keep the owner at bay in the negotiations, much like an attorney would keep the defendant away from the plaintiff and the plaintiff away from the defendant. But basically, I can tell you how I did it with IBM. I was the founder of my company. And as a result of that, when we went to Armonk, New York, for the closing signing and all the documents for the closing, I hosted a dinner for my other partners of the firm. And I remember telling them that we have a lot to be proud of and what a privilege it was for me to serve with them. But whatever you do, know this is the beginning of the end. We will all have to adapt and change. And the consulting firm that we grew and built from nothing will not look like it did just a few months from now, 6 months to a year.
So you knew what was coming, right? I mean, IBM thought they could do. Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Did.
Yep.
It was. I had been through too many transaction activities to know that no matter what you do, preserving the culture of an existing firm rarely happens when it's being acquired.
It's very the acquired company gets eaten alive, right? I mean, unless it's bigger. But in general,
Well, not always. I've been through what's called a reverse merger, and it doesn't always happen that way. I can tell you there are a number of acquisitions that have been made in which the company that operates independent from the parent and is allowed to maintain itself independent from the parent, so long as it performs well, the parent is wise to not try to interfere and make it better.
Well, that gets back to the bubble. Put the bubble around them and leave them alone and just make sure the financials are good.
That's right. That's exactly right. I think Warren Buffett has done a marvelous job in that area. However, he has been very shrewd in the kinds of companies he buys. But I think Berkshire Hathaway is a pretty good model in that end. There's other classic holding company models that have done well in that end. But more often than not, an acquiring company forgets why they're buying the company they're trying to buy. They forget about the uniqueness of that company, and they don't preserve the uniqueness because of the integration process that they put the company through.
But do you think it's because they don't realize that their own culture, it's their themselves that's causing the problem? You know what I mean? They think they can bring on somebody that, or a company that moves really quick, and they can just take them on, and that magically changes them to start moving quick. And they don't realize that you're not going to change the culture unless you change yourself. It's really difficult to get people to understand,
Sarah,
that.
I think it depends. Yeah, I think, Sarah, it depends on the purpose of the acquisition. Some acquisitions are made from larger companies with weak balance sheets, and they acquire a smaller company with a very strong balance sheet to help bolster their balance sheet, the parent balance sheet, to help improve it. In that case, it's very, very important that the acquiring company realize why they're buying it and keep it generating earnings on a continuous basis. And if you have a smart group of managers in the acquiring company, I'm talking about senior managers.
Sure.
Now, they'll do that.
Well, because otherwise eventually the company together, the acquired and the bigger one, will eventually start turning back into what the bigger company was.
That's correct.
If they don't change their habits.
Well, they may not have to change their habits at the holding company, but they certainly have to leave the acquired company alone.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And if they integrate it, if they do a full integration, then there's some issues there, right? I mean, how are you going to do
You can integrate a wholly owned subsidiary and still leave it alone. And there's lots of reasons you want to do that. Lots of reasons. There's a lot of cost savings and good integration. However, just where you potentially see a cost savings, and I can think of one example in which the client base operated entirely different on the acquired company than the client base did on the acquirer. If you try to merge those operations, you'll typically destroy the uniqueness of the company you just bought, and therefore the earnings will suffer.
Exactly. And that's just a common problem. You always have to keep that in mind, right? Because this is really what's going on in the world today, right? These buying the small companies is a very common practice for large companies, and they really need to be careful on what they're doing, why they're doing it, and make sure you don't mess up your investment.
That's correct. I would share with you, though, that the most successful companies who integrate, regardless of whether they put a bubble around them or not, are those acquirers who develop the integration plan before they close the deal.
Yes, that makes sense.
And what I mean by that is that it's between the LOI, the letter of intent, and the purchase and sale agreement, where they sit down with the acquiring company's management, and they sit literally in a room with integration specialists, and they put together the plan before the closing. And the reason you want to do that is you want to see if you're going to have cooperation with the acquired company along with the acquirer. Because if you can make it through that integration plan, chances are the culture will fit. And you quickly realize whether or not there is a fit if you begin getting pushback, uncooperation, or non-cooperation, and you find that little things that shouldn't be a problem get blown up to be a big problem. Those are really big signs of a mismatch in the culture.
And there's going to be a certain amount of that anyways, right? People come together and there's a lot of pride, but...
I think so. I think that's all dependent, though, on how well the acquiring company communicates along the way, not only through the due diligence process, but in the whole structure of why we want you as a part of our family.
Sure. And so they have to be really welcoming. They can't be, we're kings coming down and you guys are the peasants and we're taking you over because you're awful. They can't have that attitude, which I'm sure you've seen that before. They have to have more of a, you know, welcoming partnership attitude.
Absolutely.
Because no matter what, people aren't going to accept you if you're the bully coming into town.
Well, that's right. I just finished an article on that very, very subject where the stars conquer. That is, an integration team is appointed by the acquiring firm. And that team is told to get the integration done as quickly as possible because they want to realize the cost savings from the synergies. So the quickest way to get it integrated is to just adopt the acquiring firm's processes, practices, and procedures and systems because that's the fastest way to get it done.
So what happened there? They just killed the company they acquired?
That's right.
They just, and everybody just became zombies.
That's right.
Yeah, you just can't do that. You got to be smarter. If you're going to be doing this and spending this kind of money, you really have to be smart.
You sure do.
So you have a big scoop that you wanted to tell us. You want to share?
Yeah, absolutely can. Sarah, my company, Jim Strategy Management, has just been acquired by an investment banking firm. And that firm is SDR Ventures. It is a nationally known firm, a nationally recognized firm. They do deals. They're international in scope. They're headquartered here in Denver. And they work in a number of industry areas, business services, logistics, technology, healthcare, consumer products, distribution.
So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's effective as of May 1st of this year.
Wow. So you've been in this little bubble without people knowing about it.
Well, we haven't announced it yet. We're going through our own integration process. I might add that's going very well. And the company that acquired us wanted to expand its consulting advisory services because our market is changing. And we are able to compete with the largest of investment banking firms because our clients are demanding more services than just typical transaction work. So we, I'm the managing director of the consulting division.
Okay.
And what that means is that when companies decide that they want to sell their companies or when they decide they want to buy a company or they need to raise capital, we help them early on in that process before they go to market or we help them integrate companies that they might acquire. And we help them prepare to go to market. We help build their strategic plan. We'll put them through a due diligence process similar to what an acquiring company would do.
Are you going to stay on for a while?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a wonderful opportunity for our consultants in expanding their horizons. It's a much bigger platform to work for them. Therefore, we can offer a higher caliber of services because of the technology and the support systems and structures that are here. So this is good for everybody. The clients will get even greater service. The consultants will have an opportunity to leverage the platform so they can provide better services. This is a win-win for everybody, clients, SDR, and Jim Strategy Management.
Because it brings more services to the customer than what you've had, and you bring more services to what they had, and so it's a good strategic alliance.
It's a good strategic partnership.
That's great. Well, you have written for the Wall Street Journal and for Forbes, and people have could see you on every major network. But you also are a monthly columnist for a lot of different newspapers around the country. Where else can people find more about you in particular?
Well, they can go to LinkedIn. My profile is on LinkedIn, and all of the articles that I've written have been posted. They can go to the GEM Strategy, that's G-E-M, Strategy Management, Inc. website. That's www.gemstrategymanagement.com. They can go to that website. And they can see our capabilities and our subject matter expertise.
And you have,
you
have different articles and things so that people want to know if they're thinking about selling their company or if they're just kind of tinkering with it, they could go there and really learn some stuff from what you have in your articles.
That's right. If they go to the GEM Strategy Management website, they will see the major areas of consulting services we provide, which are being imported and expanded here at SDR. Number one. Number two, they can see all of the articles by subject matter that have been published by the name of the newspapers there. So they have an opportunity to go research that information, study up, read, et cetera. And then if they want to get in touch with us, there's an 800 phone number on the GEM Strategy Management website, or they can call SDR Ventures here in Denver, Colorado, and ask for me and or any of the other principals, and we're happy to visit with them and see where they are in the process and determine whether or not it's a good fit. Can we help them, and do they think they can benefit from our services?
Because it has to be a good fit, right? Because like I was saying, it's an emotional situation, and so you want to make sure that they're ready to go and
Absolutely.
That things are going to work. So I'm going to have, if you're okay with this, I'm going to put your information on the radio page and also on my website, and so people can get to it.
Excellent, Sarah. We really appreciate that.
Okay, well, great. Thank you so much for joining us today. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. You're a wonderful interviewer.
Thank you.
If you want to see more from Gary Miller, make sure you visit my website at sarahwestall.com, or you can go to webtalkradio.net to find more as well. And for now, I hope you all have a wonderful day.